Welcome to Poets and Writers Today, WEHC 90.7. You're going to be listening to the famous David Baldacci today, talking about his latest book. You heard the first part last week, so here we go.
Now, I hope you, if you've read my books, you know I do a lot of research. I don't Wikipedia or Google stuff because anybody can do that. I try to get out and do as much of this as I possibly can myself. I do draw the line at felonies. I will never commit a felony for the purposes of writing a book. That's bad, very bad. But I do like to go to almost all the places that I write about and do some of the things that my characters do. When I started my John Puller series, I knew that I wanted to sort of immerse myself in the world of the military. My dad had been in the Navy as well, and a lot of my uncles. I'm from the D.C. area, so you know the military footprint up there is enormous, and a lot of my friends are in various armed services. So a buddy of mine who was a retired colonel in the Army, he'd been a Ranger, we jumped on a plane and flew down to Fort Benning, Georgia, where the infantry and the Rangers train down there. And I wanted to spend 3.5 days down there trying to do as much as I could do and talk to as many people as I could talk about that life. Now, I found that the Army is amazingly organized and meticulous about scheduling stuff. I was there for 3.5 days. My official itinerary was like 137 pages long. You know, every 5 minutes of my life was chronicled, where I was going, who was going to take me, what I was going to do, how long I was going to be there, who was going to take me to the next place, and so on and so on. One thing they forgot to schedule, though, for the 3.5 days were meals. So I had like apples every day. That was about it. Now, the first place they took me, as soon as I got off the plane, they took me to the parachute jumping grounds. Now, there are two towers at Benning. One is a 212-foot tower that you jump off with an actual parachute attached and, you know, hopefully land safely. For liability reasons, they would not allow me to jump off of that tower. You know, thank you, God. The other tower is like a four-story tower, and on top of it is a little shack with a cutout door like a plane fuselage, and you're attached to a zip line because you can't jump with a parachute from that distance off the ground. They're going to let me jump off of that one. Now, I'm on the ground getting prepped. There's like 50 paratroopers. These guys jump out of a perfectly good plane every day, and they were giving me pointers and advice. And they had my crash helmet on. I signed all the waivers. If you die, if you die, if you die, it's not our fault. And they put the harnesses. You have to be harnessed all up and stuff. And they said, okay, like the chest harness, the straps to the cable, to the zip line is going to go right here. Don't have to worry about these. These will take care of themselves. Two thigh straps, that's the problem area. If these are not cranked down really tightly, when you jump, you're going to drop really hard. And if those harnesses around your thighs are not tight, they're going to move. They're going to hit a part of your anatomy you will never forget. So my buddy is videotaping all of this, and as I'm going up the tower, you see me cranking these straps back on my thighs so tightly I have no blood flow in my lower extremities. So I get up to the top of the tower, and the jump master, it's just me and the jump master up there, and he puts a little cable on here, and it goes out through a hole in the wall. You have to understand, looking at the doorway, you saw nothing that was going to hold you up in the air. All you saw was the open air. I didn't even see the zip line. I didn't know where it was. So the jump master said, first question, are you afraid of heights? I have to tell you, standing on the ground looking up four stories, it's not a big deal at all. Being up four stories looking straight down, you get like on the top of the Empire State Building. It just is a long way down. I said, well, you know, not until I got up here. I wasn't. He said, okay, here's what you're going to do. You know, back up to the far wall there. Get a running start. Push off as much as you can out into the open air. Jump as far away from the building as you can. The farther you jump away, you won't drop as immediately and as fast. He said, the zip line's going to engage. It's going to rip you sort of violently to the right. We're trying to simulate you jumping out of a plane at altitude and speed. He said, it's critical. If you remember nothing else I tell you today, it's critical. Keep your chin tightly pressed to your chest. And I'm a curious guy. So I said, why is that so critical? He said, well, otherwise, that cable's going to come around. It's going to slice your ear right off.
Nice.
Now, you know, I thought he was exaggerating. Until like 6 months later, I was doing a book signing for the book Zero Day. And guy comes up in line, tall, fit, you know, close cropped hair. He's got a ball cap on, looked like military. And he said, hey, I heard you jumped at Benning. I said, yeah, I did. He said, yeah, me too. I forgot to tuck. So he takes his cap off, turns, half of his ear gone. So, you know, I excused myself. I went to the restroom. I threw up. I came back and finished that signing because I'm a tough guy. So I told the jump master, that box is checked. said, now you're going to be going down to the ground at about a 45 to 50 degree angle very fast, and there'll be soldiers on the ground waiting to give you further instructions. So I looked at him. I said, excuse me, do you mean while I'm still in the air? He said, yes, sir. Now, while this was going on, the paratroopers had started a betting pool. It was 50 to 1. I wasn't jumping. The only person who bet for me was my buddy. And over a couple of beers later that night, he confessed he bet a lot more money against me. And I guess it took me, like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to sort of work up the courage to just back up against that wall and jump out into the open air with not really anything other than this thing attached that was going to keep me up, such that on the videotape, you can hear one of the paratroopers finally go, what the hell is he doing up there? Writing a damn book? I was like, why, yes. That's the whole point. So I said, I finally said, I've got to do this. I backed up against the wall. I got a running start. I jumped out into the open air as far away from the building as I could. Trust me. And I felt that stupid cable come around and flick the back of my ear. It's so weird. So then I get jerked this way, and I'm heading down to the ground really fast. And then I see that I'm heading right towards a solid dirt berm, 5-foot-tall wall. I'm heading right for it. I'm going to smash into this wall and die, basically. And my first thought was, what an idiot put a wall on the jumping grounds, you know? And then I realized that people are screaming at me, lift your feet, sir! Lift your feet immediately! Those were the further instructions. So I lifted my feet past my head, because in addition to being a tough guy, I'm very flexible. I cleared the berm, barely, and they grabbed my harness to stop me before I really hurt myself. And for that, the Army gave me a certificate. It says, congratulations, you jumped. I got that framed in my office. I look at that. And I did the sniper range. I did the Humvee rollover thing where they put you in a Humvee on this big rack and they spin you around like a top, and then you're upside down. Then you got to egress out of it as quickly as you can. And I did the Army functional fitness training. I had two master sergeants on either side of me, and for 60 minutes we did this course that the Army can come up with that soldiers actually do in the field, running and thrusting and squatting and pushing. And somehow I survived that, not really sure how. But mainly what I did, I just talked to people. You know, everybody from privates on up to generals. I interviewed them, but also just had discussions and listened to them. Because back then, this was, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan was still going pretty full bore. These guys were infantry. Most of them were like between 18 and 19. They all volunteer. And the way it worked at Fort Benning was you got 12 weeks of basic training. Some soldiers got 4 more weeks of specialized training. And the very next day, you're on a plane to Afghanistan or Iraq, and you're going to be in combat, without exception. So, you know, I'd sit down with some guys who are 18, 19, you know, my son's age. And, you know, why do you want to do this? You know, what was the decision making for doing this? And the decisions varied across the spectrum. Some guys were like, we got attacked in 9/11. I want to defend my country. I want to take the fight to them. Some guys were like, you know, this is the only shot I have at a good life. If I survive the war, I can get some education. I can learn some skills through the military. I can have family, support my family, have a good life. So really, it varied. And for me to get in the heads and hearts of people who, you know, would be characters in my novels, it was very important to me. You can't in Wikipedia or Google this. I think you can see that. And I spent a long time just sitting and listening to people. And it was, you know, some of the best research I ever did. I was fascinated by the people I met. And I think it made the John Puller series just a lot better because I'd taken the time and opportunity to do something like that because I just felt it was important. I don't want to write about subject matter, just kind of fudge stuff, because I don't like reading books like that. You know, I can tell within 5 or 10 pages that the author did any research, or just kind of fudged it. And I don't like to fudge it. On the film and TV front, the Wish You Well movie, you know, we did it 2 years ago. It stars Ellen Burstyn and Josh Lucas and Mackenzie Foy from the Twilight and Interstellar movies. We won a number of film festival awards. If you can go on YouTube, the trailer's on there, 2-minute trailer. It really gives you a nice feel for the film. We're entered into a film festival right now. We'll find out in May. If we win this film festival, we actually get limited theatrical release in AMC theaters, so that would be really good. June 2nd, though, it'll be available on DVD and streaming all over the place. So it's a beautiful film. It took like 3.5 years of my life to get this done, but it was well worth it. I was the script writer and also one of the producers, and it takes a long time to make a film, and takes an even longer time to make a good film. So if you are interested in that, if you like the book, it's very faithful to the book because adapting it was my job. And it's interesting when you're a script writer, you think, okay, the script's done, you're going to start shooting, here's a script, goodbye, see you later. That's not how it works. I was rewriting the script all the way through production. You know, the 28-day shoot that we had, every day I was rewriting scenes because things come up. You're at a location, you don't get all your shots in, and you can't go back to the location, all of a sudden you have a hole in the plot. And so I happened to rework the plot to make sure that, you know, we can keep going. You know, Alan Burstyn, I remember I'm sitting out in a farmyard with roosters and chickens all over, over me in the middle of nowhere in Virginia, and I'm rewriting a scene on a wooden table that Alan Burstyn, the Academy Award-winning actress, is waiting right now in costume in front of the camera, waiting to deliver the lines that I am writing right now for her. So there was no pressure, none. The Finisher is my young adult series. I wrote The Finisher. It took me 5 years to write The Finisher. 4.5 years was like agony because I could not understand and come to grips with the story I wanted to tell. And then after 4.5 years, I wrote the book in 6 months. And I sold the book. I sent it out to publishers under a pseudonym. I did not want anybody to buy this book because my name was attached to it. I wanted them to buy it because they loved the story. So I used the name, the pseudonym, Janus Pope. Janus is the Roman two-faced god, which I thought made sense. And, you know, Pope was, you know, just that Catholic thing. So Scholastic bought it, and the way the book is written, they thought I was a Brit from England. And so when I showed up at Scholastic headquarters in New York and walked in and said, hello, I'm Janus Pope, they were like screaming. They had no, you know, they were just had no idea it was me. So the book hit number one last year when it came out. The sequel is done. It's called The Keeper. It'll be out in September of this year. Sony Columbia bought the film rights. The first draft of the script has been done, and they see it as sort of a big fantasy franchise for them. So hopefully that will come to fruition. I signed a deal about a month ago to develop the John Puller series for network television. So that's in the works right now. So hopefully, yeah, that would be kind of cool. You heard about the Wish You Fall Foundation. My wife and I founded it about 15 years ago. We fund literacy organizations across the country. We funded programs here in North Carolina, for instance. Literacy is the most important skill you will ever have, the ability to read. The ability to read is the same verb as the ability to think. You can't do one without the other, really, certainly not in the information age that we live in now. Can imagine all of your lives right now if you couldn't read. You know, how would you process what you're supposed to process during your life? Could you do it? I don't think you could do it. I don't think you could, certainly couldn't realize your potential. So we have a huge illiteracy problem in this country. It's not an urban problem, rural problem, suburban problem. It's an American problem. And about 100 million adults, about half the adult population, read at the two lowest levels of literacy. We have 1 million high school dropouts a year. So in 20 years, we'll have 20 million people that don't even have high school education. How can they compete against people from Taiwan who have 3 PhDs? Impossible. So in many ways, we're a third world country trying to catch up education-wise, and we just need to do a better job. So the Wish You Well Foundation tries to do as much as we can, but I have to tell you, it is an enormous battle, and you know there just aren't enough resources out there to fight that battle. We just need to do a better job. That Box is a program we came up with called Feeding Body and Mind. We partnered with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks across the 50 states. And they have a huge pipeline of distribution, as you can imagine. Now, food is important. Obviously, you need food to survive. But food alone can't get you out of that cycle of poverty. Most people seeking food assistance have low literacy skills because poverty and illiteracy go hand in hand. I think we all understand that. So what we do is on my book tours, people can donate new and gently used books of any type. And once that box is full or as full as it's going to get, we send a label down and the book is sent to the local area food bank. So we go to your local area food bank here. People going in to seek food will be able to bring books home, not just for themselves, but for their children as well, because poverty is a generational cyclical thing. And what we don't want is 20 years from now, the kids of people seeking food assistance today are grown going in to seek food assistance with their kids. Having books in a home is a wonderful thing. I have seen many incredible results from books being in a home. I have never seen a good result from no books. being at home ever in my whole career as a literacy advocate. So you cannot believe how many books, how many homes in this country have never had a book in them, how many kids in this country have never owned a book. So that's a problem we're trying to eradicate with Feeding Body Mind. So feel free if you want to help with that. We'd appreciate it very much. Two stories, and I'll take some questions, and we'll sign. And I'll sign like one book every 6 seconds or something like that, I'm sure. No. I talked about research, and research is very important. Sometimes research can get you into enormous trouble, and it happened to me. Very serious. I was on an Amtrak Acela train. I was in Washington, D.C., waiting for the train to head up to New York. I'm sitting at a table that I'm sharing with two people I don't know. I'm assuming they're businessmen. They have suit and ties on. They have BlackBerry cell phones, smartphones, laptops, miniature satellite towers. They're like doing deals. And it was amazing. I was like, wow, this is so cool. And I'm on my phone, and I'm calling a friend of mine who's a medical examiner in the Bronx Medical Examiner's Office, where they have some of the most interesting wounds you will ever see in the Bronx. And she was a renowned expert on this field that I needed to know more about to write a book that turned out to be Split Second, the first in the King and Maxwell series. So I was calling her just to set up an appointment to meet with her when I got to New York. I like to do all of my interviews face-to-face. As a lawyer, I learned very early on that it's often more importantly how people say something rather than what they actually say. The body cues are like amazing. You know, they really are. I'll give you a little tidbit here. You can try this out at your leisure. Now, you want to know how someone is lying to you. If you ask somebody a question, you want to figure out if they're lying to you. No, they don't look down and to their right. You know, I love NCIS, but that's wrong. You ask them that, and you think they might be lying to you. If they do this, they rub their nose, they're probably lying to you. Yes. Why? It's a physiological reaction. People, anxiety drives blood flow to the capillaries at the end of the nose, and it makes them tingle and itch. You know, for all of us. Of course, everybody's like looking next. Were you really there last night? Yes, I was, I swear. So that's a little thing. So I like to look at the people while I'm talking to them. Unfortunately, my friend said, you know, that's not possible today. I'm about to head out to JFK. She was a forensic pathologist, a lot of special skill. She had been invited by another government to go and do an investigation of a crime overseas. It was sanctioned by the U.S. government, and she's going to be gone for 3 weeks. She would have no communication back stateside during that time because of the confidentiality of the investigation. So I could either ask her now or wait until she got back. And I said, well, you know, I can't really wait. Let's just, you know, I don't like to do it this way, but let's just do it this way. So I had my questions. I said, okay, doc, here's basically, you know, how I want to murder the guy. I know. I was young. I needed the money. Huh? And I went through my very elaborate poisoning techniques that I had given a lot of thought to, let me tell you. You know, dinner time at my house is really interesting. And I said, I need to make sure the police won't even know that I've killed this person. And she said, David, no, they won't. The way you described it to me, it's undetectable. I said, okay, but there's going to be a post-mortem done on the body. So I need to make sure I can fool a medical examiner. They won't know this person's been murdered. And she said, David, trust me. You know, I've often thought about murdering people. Good public servant that she is. And she said, if you did it exactly how you described it to me, it is undetectable. It is the perfect crime. I was like, wow, that's very nice of you to say. And I asked you a few more questions, and I ended by saying, you know, doc, if I ever need to kill anybody else, I'm going to call you. So I clicked off, I finished writing my notes, and I looked up. God. So the guy over here had spilled his coffee from his neck to his crotch. He was like one big brown stain, you know? I will never, ever forget the guy sitting right across from me. He didn't say anything, didn't make a sound. Here's what he was doing. My God. And over his shoulder, here come the Amtrak police. Amtrak has its own police department. Right? And I did not make it to New York that day. I was detained as a person of interest because of one stupid little phone call. Now, in the acknowledgement section of a book is a place where authors thank people who helped them with the book. And there's an acknowledgement section at the end of Split Second. The very last acknowledgement reads something like this. Do any and all passengers on the Amtrak Acela train who might have overheard me discussing poisoning techniques for purposes of writing the novel are probably scared out of their wits at my seemingly diabolical intent? I apologize. You know, I thought it was very fair of the judge to let me do it that way. Now, the last story answers the question I get almost as much as what it's like to be a best-selling novelist. People say, oh my God, you're a famous writer. You must get recognized in public all the time. And I'm like, no, I don't. You know, we're not really celebrities. We're sort of an anonymous celebrity. You may recognize the name. I doubt anybody would ever recognize my picture. Certainly not the guy at LAX. Anyway. But with that said, even when you are recognized in public as an author, it's not the ego stroke you think it might otherwise be. I was at a restaurant with my wife. We were having lunch. We were in a booth, and, you know, you talk and chat, and you look around from time to time. So I remember looking over, and I spotted this woman across the room, and she was having lunch, I guess, with her husband. And I looked over, and she's, like, laser-locked on me, you know, like, boom. And I was like, I flinched. I was like, oh, my God. I could not have seen what I thought. I looked over, wham, like, laser-lock. I felt like I had a red dot on my forehead. This woman was, like, creepy, and so I just stopped looking. I'm just eating my lunch, and then I sensed a presence next to me like 5 minutes later. I thought it was our waitress, and I looked up, and it's the woman. And, you know, she pushes me over in the booth and sits down next to me. And she looks at me, you know, and says, sort of in a very coy voice, "You are who I think you are, aren't you?" Any English teachers here want to try to diagram that question? I'm not really sure where the subject starts and the... Well, I'm trying to keep it calm. I don't know if she's like a psychopath, right? So I said, well, do you read a lot of fiction? And she said, oh, yes, I do. I laughed. I said, well, you got me. I guess I am who you think I am. She's like, oh, my God, this is the greatest moment of my life. I never thought I had the opportunity to meet you ever. I can't even process what is happening to me right now. This is, like, beyond my wildest dreams. And she turns and screams across the restaurant to her husband. She's like, I was right, Joe. It is John Grisham. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. It wasn't quite that funny at the time. Anyway, now, John and I are friends, known John for a long time, and every time I've asked John to do a charity event, he's always stepped up, have the greatest respect for him. I think he's a really cool guy. That moment in my life, just not feeling the love for him. And, you know, and my poor wife, to put it delicately, she blew iced tea out of her nose. I don't know if any of you have ever done that. I do have to say it's not as easy as you might think. And then she said very politely to the woman, she said, you know, that's the right genre, but the wrong author. And the woman looked mortified, and she looked at me again, and she said, oh, my God, are you Baldacci? I was like, yeah, I am. So obviously chagrined that I was not Monsieur Grisham, she turns and screams across the freaking restaurant to her husband again, you're right, Joe. It is the Italian. Thank you very much.
This is Henry McCarthy saying thank you for listening to David Baldacci today on Poets and Writers, WEHC 90.7, and thank you, Richard Graves, for all your great work.